question. Mary's ready to roll them. That's good. Well, all right. Happy spring. We're in April. This is good news. And it's warm today, more or less. It's all by comparison. I thought tonight we could start by just reviewing the last slogan that we did last week when Michael Fagan taught. It's called Seeing Confusion as the Four Kayas is Unsurpassable Shunyata Protection. I was going to say perfection. That might work. Protection. Seeing confusion as the four kayas is unsurpassable shunyata protection. So Michael Fagan gave us something to put on the website. You'll be happy to look there. And there's a good paragraph here on this slogan. I think this was one that you read online, right?
These were really what I read last week, just aloud from the Profound Treasury, from Rinpoche's book, just to help people, because it's so concisely put in terms of what we're talking about here.
So what I did actually is print out and type up these words so you could see what the kayas are, because I think Pema, I don't remember, but I don't think she actually enumerated them, right?
She does.
Does she?
I
wasn't.
I would say I had a hard time.
Right.
I didn't read it last week.
Right. It can be pretty confusing, I think. So I'd just like to touch in on this again. And what I put down, there's a lot of different ways of explaining this. So let me just say there's not just one way.
Are there copies of your handout?
Although they're exotic right now, if you stay with
that's
the
not the he has the handout.
And Buddhist studies, they're going to become something you'll encounter.
It's right
the
there.
The kayas, the three kayas.
Okay, so.
And so it's not like just a one time thing. I mean, if you're staying with this program, you will learn more about the kayas. And
they've all got it.
Don't worry, it's like it becomes very natural in terms of understanding how where the dimensions are lined up in our experience. It's actually a very simple way of putting it.
Yeah.
And so even though it sounds intimidating at first, it really is actually very easy to work with.
I was going to say last week, and I don't know if it was, I was tired or what, but what I got out of your presentation, so I hope you can take this with the heart that I'm sharing with, was this is what it's like for my students when they're not following the words I use.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep trying to explain it again and again, and the words are just getting in the way. I just felt like I was trying, but the words were getting in my way. And it wasn't that you weren't explaining. It was just like my brain was doing this activity, which was like, I can't understand this. And so every time I listened, there was that question. I can't get this.
So I thought, the way I wrote this is maybe helpful or more confusing. I don't know. But the Dharmakaya is this sense of basic openness and space. So there's a sense of vast open space. I think we can sort of get a sense of what that might be. Then if you think of the Nirmanakaya, that's sort of a situation that arises, or things arise. Things are in that space, right? There's a sense of things form, things come into that space. And then there's some link between those two. So it's not that there's a sense of some kind of energy and link between the two. So one way I think of it is Dharmakaya could be more like mind, vast mind. Nirmanakaya could be more like body, and speech is what joins mind and body.
Could spirit? No, that's not. You know,
that's okay. You can use that. You can say anything.
It could be the sambhogakaya.
Sambhogakaya.
Yeah, because it feels like, at least the way that I'm processing it at this point, is that there's the tangible, the intangible, and the vastness that holds it all. I mean, that's
And so when I think of the intangible, I think of more of something like spirit rather than speech, which is much more, it's a form, at least.
It's actually a principle rather than it's not restricted to only verbal speech or, I mean, if you think about sound as being something primordial, like vibration, if you want to go into that, you know, it's like it has a whole, we do something in Buddhism, we go body, we have
We say it.
Body is up here, speech in the throat, mind is the heart, so that's where we put mind. So mind is vast, open, and inconceivable. It's beyond the grasp. Mind cannot grasp itself. That's really important. We've been hearing this from the get-go, right? We can't grasp our mind. We don't know the dimensions of mind because it's just beyond that. But then we have, we have this bodiness or this specific element situation we're in, as she was saying, and then we have speech, a connecting point. In other words, how do we connect space and form? Think of it like that. And then spirit is the whole thing, if you really want to get into the word spirit. It's much vaster and bigger.
Well, would that be Svabhava Kakaya? The totality? It's not quite that. We don't really use spirit, do we?
I think spirit does have, is used, but in particular context. We'll get to it. Don't worry about it. But it's not going to be easy to simply find simple transfers. Oh, this is like I was raised, but I heard in church or something, or philosophy course. No, it's more experiential. We're talking about something you can know directly for yourself. That's the difference.
It's a means of communication.
Yeah.
Sambhogakaya or whatever.
Sambhogakaya. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'd like to add something to that. We have mind which is vast and unknowable.
Okay, Michael has something to say.
We have mind which is vast and unknowable. And mind can produce anything. It can go far beyond our physical situation. We can create fictions. We can create other planets of strange types. Sambhogakaya is anything mind can produce. Then we have our particular actual situation, how that embodies in our practicality, and that's nirmanakaya. So the what mind can produce is something which joins the vast spaciousness to the particulars.
You mean Dharmakaya?
Dharmakaya is vast space. Sambhogakaya is any way mind can manifest, including imagination, colors, visions of things that don't exist, as well as things that do exist. All that is what mind can manifest, which is Sambhogakaya. And then we have our actual situation, how we can be and handle the fact that our feet are on the ground. And that's nirmanakaya. Then we can see that if we have awareness of the whole thing, they just give that a name, svabhava kakaya.
It really means the self-nature of all. Svabhava kakaya is actually the meaning in the total body of all. Kaya is body in Sanskrit. So,
can you give us a real life example of that? I mean, I'm grasping a little bit what you're saying, but it really in total theory. Mm-hmm. You know, so
when would we see confusion as the four kaya? And have that be unsurpassable?
So, okay, that's good. So let's look at the slogan, seeing confusion. Okay, so confusion, we talked about confusion back when we worked with the emotions, right? And it's solidifying concepts, primarily a version of me and solidifying me. And from that, the kleshas arise, everything that, you know, passion, aggression, ignorance, and 50 million others, whatever they are. So, so that's the confusion as the four kayas. So you're basically, I think, here talking about seeing the confusion as actual wisdom, and wisdom in many different aspects. I'm just, you know, trying the best I can here.
And so it's like it the poisons. The poisons are the remedy.
Yes, right. So within the actual poison is the wisdom. We're not saying get rid of aggression or get rid of, or that's really bad. We're from that, from a higher view, we're saying from the ultimate view, with the problem contains the answer, or the poison contains the medicine. As you talked about the peacock, right? So, in your talk. Shunyata aspect, shunyata means emptiness. So that means emptiness. And other ways of thinking beyond concept or wisdom. I'm not sure wisdom is exactly shunyata.
Wisdom is kind of embracing this, but shunyata is emptiness. We talked about emptiness before as being fundamentally open and not solid. In other words, emptiness means in actual sense that there's nothing really solid here. When we view confusion is this notion of something as being solid, and we're forgetting that when we went back to those first absolute slogans, it helps to go back and,
right,
and contemplate those slogans, that fundamentally, when we actually sit and we try to find out where our thoughts come from, we cannot find out where they come from. They show up, right? We can't find a beginning, and when we actually look for where they dwell, we can't see that they actually occupy a space. Do they have a color, a shape, a texture? Do they have a, you know, when we actually look at these, we can't find them. When we actually look at where they go, what happened to this big thought that I was totally possessed by 2 minutes ago? I can't find it at all. It didn't go somewhere that I can locate and recover. It's gone. I mean, this is how we begin to understand space. That fundamentally, emptiness is open and it's non-graspable. So all of our habits of feeling like something's real is beginning to get kind of transparent. We begin to realize what I'm doing is I'm thinking something's real, which is just appearing in my mind. I'm believing what's coming into my mind. I think it's real because it's in my thoughts.
So we're starting to see through the confusion and, in a way, seeing the emptiness quality of the confusion.
But were you asking, like, when would, like, I'd be going through my day and I'd say, oh, now I get it. Now's when I want to see confusion
as. Well, I was more asking, like, what are the steps here? You know, and what is an example of going from Dharmakaya to, you know, like,
you want
to,
okay, so a guy's walking down the street. That's where you want to start, right?
Yeah.
I don't think you can. I don't think you can parse it like
sort
that.
Of example of that, of those four. Of the four kinds.
It's not a sequence.
It's not a sequence.
It's inseparable. That's why
it's inseparable.
It's eventually getting the whole thing is called the Bhavakaya. It's
right, and I guess
it's the totality of one's experience.
Even if it's not separable, is there a way to describe it in a way that's an example of how it works?
So we have a method of presenting something called ground path and fruition. This is basic. This is how we learn logic in Buddhist thinking. Ground, we're looking at the ground. Ground is some kind of basis. Once you have a basis, then you can have a ground.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about introducing from the very beginning of the teachings, we talked about this basic ground that we are completely ignorant of. We, even though it surrounds us and is us and in us and outside and everywhere, we ignore it entirely because we get caught up with seeing things that we think that appear out of the ground as being real. And then, you know, one of the things, this comes back to the whole notion of impermanence. Everything that we experience is impermanent. And everything that's compounded, meaning a relationship, the way these atoms are together, and molecules that basically form this chair, and all the elements that we see are all compounded. They are impermanent. They seem to be here, and we experience them, but they're not permanent. They weren't here a million years ago. They're not going to be here a million years from now, or even a thousand years. I mean, it's fundamentally learning about how impermanent and the Four Noble Truths tie in with what we're talking about.
And so, we're going to work more with that, too, next chapter.
Yeah, so the path, you have a ground, and you have a basis, and then you have arising. So you have things that arise out of this ground. In the case of this Dharmakaya, it's, all right, do you know fractals? Have you heard about fractals? Mm-hmm. Fractals is actually a remarkable way of understanding how everything comes out of nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually, there's some wonderful books for dummies, you know, because I need this too, in terms of explaining how fractal geometry works and how fractals actually work.
So I think we have to move on to the next.
That helps a lot. Thank you.
So, in sum, this is a very hard slogan to understand. Some slogans are very obvious, and we can pull them out in our daily life. But I just wanted to touch on it again, even though I knew it would be difficult. But it's still going to be difficult. But that's okay. So then we just, you know, actually that's part of the path. You know, there are things we aren't going to understand for a long time, or, you know, and other things we get right away. So this list is like that. There are things that are really hard. So I actually made a mistake on here. I wrote, grant your blessing so that confusion is transformed into wisdom, but it's, this is what we say when we start a meditation practice. This is the fourth line of the four dharmas of Gampopa. Grant your blessings so that confusion may dawn as wisdom. And I just put that in there because I thought it related to the slogan.
That's actually an alternative translation to Rinpoche used both of those. In the first translation he made of the... the first translation...
For the Lojong slogan?
Yeah, well, the first translation... grant your blessing.
Is transformed into wisdom, you mean?
Yeah, the first translation was transformed into wisdom.
Oh, really?
Later,
I didn't know that.
Dawned as wisdom.
Well, there you go.
You're so smart.
Well, then I guess that maybe there's no mistake. I must have transformed confusion into wisdom, just like that.
Well, it dawns as wisdom because there's no, nothing turns into something else.
Right, it dawns, right.
But that's the difference between what we call
language.
Also, the path, which we are engaged in dynamically to transform our poisons into wisdom through practice. And at the same time, ultimately, they already are there. That's the dawning. It's actually our perceptions change. We can actually see fundamentally how everything is completely pure. In that process, everything is completely liberated in wisdom.
Okay, so we're going to move on. So tonight we're going to be covering point three of the Lojong slogans. Number 15, four practices are the best of methods. Number 16, whatever you meet unexpectedly, join with meditation. And then we'll move on to point four. 17 is practice the five strengths, the condensed heart instructions. And 18 is the Mahayana instruction for ejection of consciousness at death, is the five strengths. How you conduct yourself is important. Okay, so it's important not to get too swamped by lists or frustrated by numbers, which was my basic approach to Buddhism all along, was, oh no, the five of this, the three of this, I'll never get it. But actually, it can be helpful to have these lists because even though we may never remember them, they actually do help. So, to move on. So we're in point three, which is transformation of bad circumstances into the path of enlightenment. And the slogan is four practices are the best of methods. So I basically made, most of my comments were based on Pema's book, since that's what you've been reading. So she talks about this as four ways to overcome resistance to waking up. And basically, these four are all about relating to what's difficult, and that would be the bad circumstances, and transmuting it. So that's bringing it into the path of enlightenment. So again, it's sort of the idea of things happen, negative things happen, but we don't really have to suffer if we actually see how to work with it properly. So these four practices are accumulating merit, confessing evil actions, there are four parts there, feeding the ghosts or demons, and offering to the protectors. Now that may sound kind of odd, but the first one is offering, and the way Pema describes it is it's about opening and giving. And it's really being willing to step out of our cocoon of self-cherishing and softening up and being willing to open and give. So there's merit that comes from making offerings. So traditionally in Buddhist society in India, there's a lot of practice around making offerings, and that is a benefit, and you can gain merit. But it's not like a bank account. If I donate this much, I'll get this much credit in my account. It doesn't really work like that, but there is a sense of it transforms you in some way because you're able to be generous and open your heart. So there's a sense of the offering as a very powerful way to transform your holding on. Does that make sense? The second one is confessing evil actions. And this is a strange language to us, but we already know with the word klesha, that's neurotic behavior. So that's what we're talking about here. And confessing is to nobody. We don't, you know, there's nobody out there. And we're basically acknowledging it to ourselves. So we're looking at what we do. So it's acknowledging to ourselves that our neurotic behavior can harm other people. So that is about like being stuck in habitual patterns and how that can cause ourselves and other people harm or difficulty. So although Pema didn't say it in this book, I think she calls it somewhere else. She talks about the four R's, which is, you know, really helpful. So these are the four R's. The first one is regret. So regret, because we practice meditation, we start to see our patterns. Like if you start looking at what, just sitting in meditation, your mind is going around and you may have only three stations you're basically working on and you keep going back and forth, and when you're on one station then you switch to the next and you start noticing your little groove. So you can kind of see what you're doing, and so it says, I wrote, because of your meditation practice you see more clearly when you're acting from neurosis rather than clarity. So you can notice, feel regret, and then drop it. So the idea isn't to hang out in regret or guilt or, like, none of that is in Buddhism. It's really whatever we learn, we use that. It's fuel. Basically, it's beneficial to us. The second one under confessing evil actions is refraining. So refraining is this gentle reminder to yourself of where this neurotic action always takes you. You can pause and ask yourself, do I really want to go down that road again? So this is where, because of mindfulness, we know we can pause and see clearly what we're doing. And then refraining is actually beyond just noticing, but it's actually where we can kind of cut that next step to this habitual pattern, whatever it might be, towards responding to this person with anger, towards irritation at so-and-so, towards, I just have to have another cookie, or I'll eat the whole bag of potato chips, whatever it is. So I hope I'm not revealing any too much here. I don't like potato chips, but give me that cookie. The third one is remedial action. So remedial action is to do something that reinforces the direction we want to go in. So we're changing course here, and then we want to reinforce that pattern. So interestingly enough, so Pema talks about taking refuge in the three jewels as a way of working with remedial action, which is a traditional way of explaining this, I'm sure. So we can think about the Buddha, who actually attained enlightenment and gave these teachings, the Dharma, the path or the teachings of Buddhism, and the Sangha, the support of the fellow community of practitioners. So that's one aspect of remedial action. So, or you can just think about it as like making another choice, and that works. The fourth is resolution. So that's to resolve not to do it again. So you have made this change and you notice that that's the path you want to follow, that's the groove you want to be in, and then there's a resolution to not keep going. Do you have any questions about that section or accumulating merit or so far, anything?
In terms of taking refuge in the three jewels, is this, especially with regards to the Buddha and to Dharma, the first two, is that, I'm asking how to do that, is that like just sitting, you know, just go and meditate? I mean, essentially, you know, and, you know, listen to and sit it through?
Yeah, I think it's reflection.
Yeah.
And reflecting on those three as a way of support. So instead of taking refuge in our usual methods, which are escapism or addiction, or we have, you know, hundreds of ways we can hang on to, you know, like whatever it's going to be, we're turning towards a different support system, I think. I think it's a lot like AA, although I haven't really worked with that, but I think there's some similarity. When I read this list, it makes me think about that. Maybe there's some correlation there to that pathway.
Because I've taken to walking around with a little pocket, you know, pocket pen of shoga, you know.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, you know.
Dharma in a pocket.
Dharma,
exactly.
Yeah. No, that's great. Yeah. That helps, doesn't it?
It does.
You know, like these little supports. Mm-hmm. So we're making substitutions. I mean, you think about, you know, I think about a 2-year-old, you know, you want to get the scissors away, but you have to give them something else. So you give another tool. So we're
changing.
Changing it up with that. Chainsaw. No, Elise, we aren't going to do that.
Oh. I mean, that would be helpful, what Megan just said. Uh-huh. Is there such a...
There are.
There are, really?
The whole bunches of them now.
Oh. Okay.
Those are the little books, the tiny books.
The pocket
Pema children. Pocket Pema children. Yeah,
there's a couple. There are two or three. Cultivating loving kindness.
Yeah. Loving kindness, yeah.
I thought you just made that up.
No, because you can put it in your purse. And you can have it on the subway. You don't need to carry a whole book with you. And you can just open it to different things.
Okay.
During a meeting. Yeah. You could,
cheat.
Yeah.
Yeah, she suggested that. I mean, she's made a book to do what she was suggesting in the book, too, which is, you know, teach yourself the Dharma.
Right.
Which I thought was such a nice, simple idea. Very accessible. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Taking refuge is also a formal ceremony done publicly to say, I am considering myself as having entered into the Buddhist path and I will take these three refuges from a teacher and in front of a group of people, and that's something one can prepare for and turn it into a public celebration.
Yeah, it is a public celebration.
It is public in the sense of those who are committed to it, yeah.
Usually it's done with fellow Sangha people. I mean, you know, not that
I'm kind of leaving the Sangha piece out. Doesn't count.
You can't leave any of those three out. And we have worked with some people to find a way to do that and a teacher to give them the precepts. Mm-hmm. It's something one can do.
Yeah, if anybody's interested, let us know, because we have some local lamas who are very good for this, and they speak English.
Yes, we took two students from Nashua to someone in Cambridge. So, you know, or if our group feels, if there are enough people that are really interested, we could make it happen here. So taking refuge is, as Michael said, I mean, it's a formal step and saying, I'm stepping formally on the Buddha's path, and this is my refuge now. It's the Buddha, not as a person, but as an example of an awakened being. And basically, you're saying, I'm awakened. I'll take refuge. You're really taking refuge in your own Buddha nature. Mm-hmm. And taking refuge in the Dharma is the path, the teachings. And as we know, there's nothing to believe in. But there are steps. And then the Sangha is the community of practitioners. So it's so that's something in our group we can, you know, if people really want to do that at some point, just let us know. We can make that happen when people are ready. So the next one, number three, under the four practices of Beth, are the best method. It's feeding the ghosts is the way it's traditionally. It's not in there. Yeah, feeding the ghosts. Pema writes it that way. Another word is demons, you could say, and this word is dun. There's supposed to be an umlaut over the O, but I couldn't figure out where it was on my computer. So, sorry about that. So the duns. So again, there's some words that are kind of strange. And also, Trolog Rinpoche calls it offering to the evil spirits. So there's lots of different things. But it's about actually making offerings. Traditionally, Torma is a little cake that's made out of barley and butter, and that's sort of a literal offering that was made. But it's really about being willing to invite in this difficult energy or meeting that energy, because this whole section is transformation of bad circumstances into the path of enlightenment. So the way Pema described it was relating to your unreasonableness. So sometimes we have these days where we're just like completely wacko. I don't know if that happens to you, but when that happens to me, I try to stay away from everybody. But it's sort of, she talks about making a relationship with your neurosis. So basically, instead of trying to get away from that, you approach it. So that's the whole point of Lojong and mind training, right? Is always about drawing in, welcoming in difficulty, appreciating all of this, because we're not trying to push anything away. That's the switcheroo. We're always welcoming in.
So it's sort of having awareness instead of like, oh, I don't like that, I'm not going to look.
Right, no.
And then it won't be there because I didn't look at it.
Right, no. It's totally being, yeah, it's being aware and welcoming in. There's a little section in the Trolog Rinpoche book I can read. So the example of this is often talking about Milarepa, you sang a song by Milarepa. Oh, you'll get it. You'll bring it next time, Milarepa. So he writes, and he was a great yogi in Tibet, and sang all these songs. They were basically songs of realization. So he was in caves for a long time. Spent a lot of time in a cave. The famous Tibetan yogi Milarepa says that if we are frightened, evil spirits will arise, regardless of whether they are real or imagined. Actually, I want to back up. Even if evil spirits don't actually exist, if you perform this ritual, he's just talking about offering to the spirits, as if you really did believe in them, it will still bring some psychological relief. Sometimes when people feel really depressed, vulnerable, or edgy, they fall back on an assumption that something nasty and otherworldly is hovering around them. The famous Tibetan yogi Milarepa says that if we are frightened, evil spirits will arise, regardless of whether they are real or imagined. There is a story about how one day Milarepa returned to his cave to find it filled with spirits. Initially frightened, he tried to subjugate them, demanding that they leave, but to no avail. Only when he generated bodhicitta and sent waves of compassion toward them did they vanish. In the song, oh, and then there's a song from the book. Red Rock Agate Mountain is in the book that you have. So basically he welcomed in these spirits, and they were just manifestations of his mind. And when he was willing to actually welcome them in, he was able to tame this energy because he wasn't rejecting it or pushing it away. So that's the basic message. Yes?
I think Penna says something very well.
Okay.
In the paragraph of this. The sudden unreasonableness or just out craziness wakes you up. You begin to realize, wait a minute, I just don't have to go with this. And you should regard that as best rather than trying to get rid of it. So on the outer level, you give the den a cake. On the inner level, you see that a den has risen and that it has all this force, but you refrain from blackening anybody's eyes from acting it out. And you also refrain from repressing it. You take the middle way yet again and let yourself be there with the full force of the den. Being there has the power to purify you. That's a description of 100% mindfulness.
Mm.
You know what's hard about this?
No.
I've thought about this. It's the piece they say, just feel it, because you spent so much time saying, if I feel that, if I notice that, it's so powerful. I won't, like, sort of looking at the dons and saying, it'll be fine. You're like, no, I think they're scary.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's that scariness.
It is.
Like, I've always done it this way.
Right.
And I'm still here. So
why would I choose that?
Yeah. I mean, it's that, yeah. Why would I choose to look at it? That's what's scary.
Well.
Because you.
Yeah, I've had this movie example, movie characters. If you think of someone who isn't going to work through it, whose demons can erupt any time, take any Clint Eastwood character. And if you want someone who really has made peace with his demons, take any Morgan Freeman character.
If you've ever had to work with a nightmare, one of the ways that can actually occur is if you're just willing to be there with it on the spot and just, use your breathing with it. I remember doing this at a certain point when I realized, well, I'm in a nightmare. And, it just sort of dissipates on the spot with just being present. So that's why our meditation practice is so important, mm-hmm. because it actually is giving us the power to work with negative energy that emerges by just simply being there. We're not going to get swept away in it. We're going to actually just, it pops. It suddenly loses its grip on us. And that's kind of magical. Like the sun coming out after a huge black storm, suddenly, and it's just happening all the time. So I think the meditation practice is essential. If we do this, it starts to seep in. It starts to become kind of second nature to us rather than some extra thing we're doing. It's more like our first nature.
Yeah. Right. We're shifting into that. So the last one in this four practices or the best of methods is offering to the protectors. And the idea of the protectors, it's this principle of protecting your awakened mind or your enlightened mind. And the one way I think of it is, when one example that we experience all the time, when we're meditating and we go off, our mind goes off into some storyline and we're stuck there, then at some point we're back. And there's, you know, well, why did we come back, you know? There's something, there's this shift back to being present. So to me, that's one way I can think of the protectors. But there's another example that Trungpa Rinpoche gave that, you know, it's, one example is like if somebody's really, really mad and, you know, they go out the door and they slam the door and they catch their thumb in the door. You know, it's a sort of a sense of this this manifestation of the negative energy that actually wakes them up. So the protector is some principle of protecting our mind, the Dharma. It's really protecting the Dharma. Any questions, comments, further contributions? Does Pema say more about that? I think it's really about waking up and the protectors helping us in that way. But they're not, again, they're not anything real out there. It's all about your own mind. It's nothing that's separate from you either. Is that confusing?
In here, out there.
What seems hard to me is the refraining and then the feeding. The refraining is, you know, pushing it away so you're not going in that direction.
No, it's neither pushing it away nor repressing.
Okay, it's refraining. Well, then how? That's the way, I don't know how else to think of it.
You're refraining from hurting yourself. I guess I can.
But you're just sort of saying, I have a choice, and I'm making a choice that doesn't take me down the path that I keep going down and getting negative
and
results.
Yeah, that's,
but you're not pushing away, you're just
that's
saying,
like a,
I'm here and I go right or left.
It's more like not indulging.
Yeah.
I can
see
where that's
going. But then at the same time, you've got feeding.
You're not feeding your neurosis. You're allowing your neurosis to be eaten up.
Well, it sounds to me like you're trying to refrain, but you're not doing a great job at it, so at some point you start to at least accept it a little bit, or I don't know how those bounce back.
Coming back into this fresh moment where we're all failing everywhere. We're all running into the door. We're doing stupid things. We're human beings. You know, we're not pretending we're super people. We're just talking about how it is in the human realm, coping with neurotic thoughts and impulses that come up, whether I think they're coming at me or whether it's me coming at. The point is, at a certain point, if I can just see it, if I just have that little moment of space, I can decide whether I really want to indulge in it or not. I can see fear. Do I want to, like, go, oh, I should believe this is real, you know, and just give myself to it? Or can I just be there and let it sort of go its own way?
I guess it's like I've tried to do those things and they don't work, so maybe that's why I'm here.
We keep working on it. This is why the meditation practice strengthens our capacity to have this, what we call prajna, discrimination. We can actually discriminate. We can actually go, oh, you know, there's a yes or no here.
And just noticing that you missed it is helpful.
Yeah.
You know? And it's not about beating yourself up. So there's so many different aspects. Even if you repeat the same pattern and you feel like, oh my God, there I go again. That's okay. I mean, eventually we just keep working on this.
That's the same like the image of coming back to your breath.
Coming back to your breath. That's right. Without judgment.
This is the mindful gap. Pause before you desire, but you don't.
You don't leap.
Attach.
Right.
You don't attach, but you don't.
You can make a different choice.
Yeah. So don't eat the cookie. Supposedly.
I was sharing an interesting thing.
Or eat the cookie.
It's okay.
And let it go.
finally you wear it out. You wear it out. It wears out.
When I spoke about that mindful gap at the mm-hmm. service, mm-hmm. it was interesting. After the service, someone who's on the board of the church with me came up and said, last month at our meeting, I jumped all over you about something. And I'm saying now, I now realize, three weeks later, I was just upset about it. I shouldn't have yelled at you about it. So, I wasn't deeply bothered. I kind of had that feeling. She said, no, but what you said made me think. Mm-hmm. I can go back and say, in the moment, I just did that thing where, like, somebody doesn't do what I want, is getting in my way. I'm an uproar. But then I can realize, like, oh, that's... She said, what you said made me think of that.
So the power of the Dharma. Okay, so we're gonna move on. So I'd like to get through what we had planned for today, since we have a ways to go still. So the next point is 16. Whatever you meet unexpectedly, join with meditation. So that's pretty direct and simple. So everything that arises can be seen as an opportunity. So nothing that we encounter is actually seen as an interruption, but it's an opportunity for waking up. As Pema says, surprises are gifts. So sometimes things come to us that obviously we don't want, but everything that comes is a possibility for waking up in some way. She said, when something stops your mind, rest in that gap, that big space. These moments of the unexpected are great opportunities to rest in Alaya. So that's the earlier slogan 5, rest in the nature of Alaya, the essence, which is one of the absolute slogans. Also, this is like the experience at the time of death. So this is what's actually leading us into the next point. Does anyone have any comments on that? That's pretty straightforward, I think. So point four is called transformation of bad circumstances into the path of enlightenment. That's 3. Sorry. Point four is showing the utilization of practice in one's whole life. And the way Trala Rinpoche talks about this, he calls it maintaining the practice for the duration of our lives. So I think that I like that word better than utilization. But basically, we're just going to do this. Now that we know what we're working on, we just keep at it. So point 17 is called Practice the 5 Strengths, the Condensed Heart Instruction. And this is really a pith teaching, very core teaching. So it says, these are things that Pema said. Actually, I wanted to just read, we don't have too much time, but I'm going to read this one little section, which I thought gave a really good outline of this one. It's on page 82. The underlying point of all our study and practice is that the happiness we seek is here to connect with at any time. The happiness we seek is our birthright. To discover it, we need to be more gentle with ourselves, more compassionate toward ourselves and our universe. The happiness we seek cannot be found through grasping, trying to hold on to things. It cannot be found through getting serious and uptight about wanting things to go in the direction that we think will bring happiness. We are always taking hold of the wrong end of the stick. The point is that the happiness we seek is already here, and it will be found through relaxation and letting go rather than through struggle. So these 5 strengths are basically what we already know we can do. We can do all of these things. And this is a reminder of the strength we already have. And it's all about learning to let go and relax rather than solidifying. And she says, stop struggling against the fact that nothing's solid to begin with and things don't last. So the 5 strengths are both, these 2 are together. 17 and 18, and 18 has to do with the five strengths at the time of death. And I think you can see how they relate as we go through this. So the first one is strong determination. And again, it's determination to use whatever comes to us as a chance to open up and relax, to open our heart and soften. So it's a constant determination not to shut down and withdraw, but to really practice fully. The second one is familiarization. So it's about overcoming habitual patterns and negativity. And Pema talks about it as the Dharma is so familiar, our first thought can be to apply the teachings we learned so we know that we have everything we need. The third one is called the seed of virtue. And again, she talks about the enlightened potential is in us and we can relax into that. But another way of talking about that is that when we do things that actually are positive, we are making kind of positive imprints, you could say, in our karmic path. And that's very beneficial. So it's being aware of doing things that actually bring benefit rather than harm. Those are seeds of virtue. And being aware of that. Not putting ourselves down, but, you know, we can then go on to the next step, which is reproach. So with gentleness and humor, we can encourage ourselves. So this is important, the sense of humor. And there's a sense of, oh, there I go again. So it's not, oh, no, I'm there I go again, and now I'm a terrible person, and I've done this 1,000 times. You know, it's learning to cut all of that crap that we lay on ourselves over and over again. We're not doing that anymore. We can just give it up. So the reproach isn't... It's it looks like, you know, we should reproach ourselves and how bad we are. But that's not the point. The point is we notice and we can change. We go on. The last one is called aspiration. Pema calls it aspiration. Probably that came from Trungpa Rinpoche. And Trolig Rinpoche calls it dedication of merit. But basically it's making further aspiration that we can, you know, whatever it is where we're stuck, may I be easier on myself. May I be kinder to other people. May I appreciate what I have. I always say this in the winter, I always say, when it's hot in the summer, I'm not going to complain. May I not complain in the summer, because I'm trying not to complain in the winter. But. So, you know, it's really, does this, any of this make sense? Okay, it's not that complicated. Some of these are easier to get, you know.
It's better than the
Caius. It's better than the
Caius. Say all the words.
Right.
Another thing is that these are all connected with taking refuge. When we take refuge on the spot, we're not only doing it in some kind of formal like ceremony, but we're actually doing it day in, day out. That's when we actually can learn how to find these five strengths, is actually in the refuge itself. We actually find that determination to just, it comes. Mm-hmm. When we develop a stronger mind with the refuge, we familiarize ourselves with Dharma. We have the seed of virtue, we understand, we appreciate fundamentally, even if we don't see it 99% of the time, our own enlightened potential. The reproach is recognizing how things are just, these obstacles and stupidities are part of my path, and actually you could almost view them with a certain degree of preciousness because they're helping me wake up, even though it's like they call the mishap lineage because we're always screwing up. And aspiration, may I be, you know, aspiration is really aspiring not only for myself but for everyone, so that I realize this is the human condition is one of potential, pure potential. We have so much to offer. We have so much we can do, so much that we can be. I mean, and there's this reality that is present And sometimes we have the opportunity to glimpse that. Once we do that, we realize, well, it's here already. It's not like something I have to make or build or something. It's actually right here now.
Yeah, Mary.
The one thing that I've learned is the gentleness. It's as if if I'm going to be soft with myself and would I be going, you failed, you did this wrong, if I were talking to somebody else.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't do that to somebody else, so why am I doing it to me?
Mm-hmm.
So softening the whole thing.
Right.
It's interesting. Today I was in the market and this woman said, oh, I put my basket in front of you and I hate when people do that to me, and I had no issue about it at all. I just felt really soft. And it was interesting that it bothered her that people do it to her, and then she was a person who does that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting how if you end up being soft and do it with others and do it with yourself, I don't know, it just sort of ripples.
It does ripple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's like a goal for me, is just to be softer with myself.
Right.
And when I start hearing a rah, 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 I think, God, I wouldn't have that as a best friend.
Right.
So why am I doing it?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know, that helps
that's,
me.
I think that's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we all do it on some level, you know. And we play our records over and over.
Yeah,
and they are really
right.
boring. But, you know. But that's the first step, is noticing. And then we can cut that and actually make a conscious effort. Like if we notice that, you know, what our pattern is, then we look at the other side, like you said. I mean, develop gentleness. I'm very speedy, and I can get pretty aggressive because I've got to, you know, do this now. And I realize I could actually just lighten up. You know? It's not all that important. But we only have 1 minute left, so we have to hurry up.
I think what makes it hard, too, is that we're kind of advised in this to kind of, you know, lessen your clashes or whatever. And, you know, so then when you are trying to be gentle because they're happening, it almost feels like a double-edged sword. You know, like, it's okay, they're happening, but I'm not supposed to be, they're supposed to be decreasing. You know, so you pass judgment on them. You're more apt to, at least that's what I find. You know, it's hard to just say, oh, it's there again, when you're supposed to be getting better.
Well,
that's a very important thing to have to watch out for.
Watch out.
We are not trying to get better.
Yeah, I know.
This is a big trap.
Yeah. No, but so sense of humor, okay,
yeah.
And laugh. Oh, okay, there
right,
it is
there
again. And then, okay, you can aspire to drop it or aspire to use some of these, you know, as the next sentence, you know. Come in with the next sentence being applying one of the Lojong slogans or something.
Yeah.
So the slogan 18 is the Mahayana instruction for ejection of consciousness at death is the five strengths. How you conduct yourself is important. So ejection of consciousness is actually a practice that realized teachers do, or even maybe they're not, maybe the semi-realized. But there's a practice at the time of death. But, you know, we aren't there, so we don't have a whole lot to say about that. But we can just really apply it in our situation, that bringing in the realization that death is real, it can happen at any moment, that actually this is very powerful in being willing to work with our path and take it seriously, that we can apply these five strengths in that way also. So the most important thing here is about understanding and egolessness, which we'll be talking more about in the next class that we do. And understanding egolessness and letting go are key to understanding how to meet your death. So that's so important. And also, I said practicing mindfulness and letting go of thoughts is a good place to start. So it's all really, in a way, we're saying the same thing over and over again, but just different ways. And we're talking about it from the point of view of the meditation practice. You're knowing your mind. You're getting familiar with your thoughts and what's going on, and you're learning to let go. You're learning to accept, relax, be gentle. And in daily life, we're trying to remember these slogans and bring them in more and more, as much as we can.
Can I say it in a different way?
Yes. Like.
So we have slogans 17 and 18, and the best way to live our life is also the best way to die. What's workable for our whole life is also workable when it's time to die. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's a pair.
You had a question about Mahayana?
What does that mean?
Yeah. Mahayana. Briefly, we talk about, in Tibetan Buddhism has a structure. They talk about Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. And I think we may have that on other earlier handouts or other classes, I think. In fact, I think it was in the beginning of, well, I'll look it up and let you know. But it's in one of the talks that I gave. I did an outline of that. And there's a handout online, I think, relating to that. Mahayana has to do with the, Maha means great, and Yana is vehicle. So it's the path that has to do with working with others. And the Hinayana is the narrow vehicle. And that's starting with yourself. We all start there. We have to look at ourselves and figure out what's going on and start practicing. And we're there because we're trying to figure out what's going to make us happy, right? So then we start learning more and more, and we realize, oh, there's a bigger world. And it's not just about making myself happy or free from suffering, but there's a lot of people out there. So then you're taking in a bigger world. And that's why these slogans, this is Mahayana teachings. It has to do with working with others. I mean, you're working on yourself, but you're working with others. And then Vajrayana, Vajra is the diamond vehicle. And as Pumlap Rinpoche says, they actually do paint the roads with diamonds on the left lane. That's the fast lane. And Vajrayana is the fast path. And it's the jet plane. So basically, it's the skillful means is very advanced in Vajrayana. But it really falls within the Mahayana in terms of the view. It's just that the means for liberation are much more rapid, which it's also considered much more dangerous because you could kind of fall off the cliff fast. So
it's dangerous because you are not basically establishing yourself and continuously applying the Mahayana view. In other words, the Mahayana view is everything. You're not only thinking about or working towards the liberation of yourself, but everyone and everything. So it's a much vaster and incorporates everything. There's nothing that's outside of the Mahayana. That's why it means it's because it's great. The Vajrayana is kind of inside that as a means to actually attain Buddhahood in a single or a few lifetimes as opposed to 5 trillion, which is moving along pretty slowly.
Oh. So we're a few minutes over, so I think we'll conclude here.
Is that okay?
Sure.